rushed after him. On the toilet was the third mannequin, smaller, a child. They had even drawn in curly hair on the head, like Molly's. The robe belt held her upright. Ligature marks had been drawn in around her throat. X's had been drawn over her eyes. The killers had indeed replicated exactly what had happened at Decker's home, but fortunately substituting mannequins for real people. But there was one difference, a significant one. Above the toilet were words inked onto the wall. This could so easily have been real, but ask yourself this. How much pain will you cause, bro? End it now. Do the right thing, like you should have back then. Find the courage. Don't be a coward, bro. Not now. Or next time, the blood will be real. Last chance. Decker stared at the words for the longest time. Then he turned and left the room, took the steps two at a time, and walked outside. Lancaster and Miller followed him. She caught up with him at the end of the driveway.
Where are you going?
I'm sorry for all this, Mary.
You have nothing to be sorry for. My family is fine.
They won't be next time. They'll be dead.
No, they won't. Look, this is not about you. It's about them.
No. It's about me and them. He set off down the street as snowflakes swirled around him. Chapter 49. Decker was sitting on the bed in his room at the Residence Inn. The snow continued to fall outside, but the ground was warm enough that most of it wasn't sticking. It was just slush, just like his mind was. My wonderfully perfect mind that remembers all. But parts of his thoughts were crystal clear. In his hand, Decker held his pistol. A nice, serviceable weapon. He had carried it with him as a detective, and had brought it with him into civilian life. This was also the pistol he had first stuck in his mouth and then placed against his head as he sat on the floor staring at his dead daughter. He had not pulled the trigger that night and still didn't exactly know why. With a perfect memory did not come a perfect mind or resolute decisions. Sometimes, with perfection on one end of the equation, one was left with stark imprecision on the other. Perhaps it was nature's way of balancing things. Regardless, he had not killed himself that night. But tonight was a new night, wasn't it? He racked the slide and heard a round fall neatly into the chamber. He nudged off the safety and raised the weapon to his head, placing it against the right temple. Find the courage. Don't be a coward, bro. End it now. Decker thought that there must be both courage and cowardice in killing oneself. Did he have enough of both? Or was he totally lacking? Yet he thought he did. Now, anyway. He closed his eyes and let his finger drift to the trigger guard, and then to the trigger. A couple foot-pounds of pressure and it would be over. It was the narrowest gap in the world between the finger and the trigger. A simple movement. Hook the digit and pull back. Folks did it every day, only not with a gun. He tried to clear his mind, to just relax and let go of whatever it was that was tethering him to this world. It couldn't be much. What exactly did he have left? The image of first Molly and then Cassie eased into his mind. Two frames of memory he could never let go, even if he could somehow release all the others. He held on them, his DVR momentarily frozen. The knock on the door caused him to open his eyes. He didn't move. The knock came again. "Amos? Amos, I know you're in there. Please open the door." The images of Cassie and Molly held for an instant longer, and then the frames rolled through, and other visuals took their place. Decker rose and opened the door. Captain Miller stared back at him, the collar of his overcoat turned up against the cold, beaten-up old galoshes on his feet. "I want to talk to you," said Miller, "right now." He didn't wait to be invited in. He strode past Decker into the small room. His gaze alighted on the pistol on the bed where Decker had dropped it. Miller glanced sharply at him. "You do that, they win, you know."
"Do they?"
Decker said. Miller picked up the pistol, engaged the safety, and placed it on the bureau against the wall before sitting on the edge of the bed. Decker closed the door and sat in a chair across from him.
"Of course they do," said Miller,
"since you're the only one who has a shot at taking them down. They got you to eliminate yourself. They have free rein to keep doing what they're doing. If their goal is to punish me, destroy me, then once they do, there's nothing more for them to do. Until they figure that someone else has disrespected them. And there's the small matter of letting this filth get away with killing all those people. I don't intend to let it happen, and I don't think you do either."
Decker glanced over at the gun and then back at Miller.
Miller said, "We can't bring any of them back. The only thing we can do is make this right by catching the people who killed them and make sure they never, ever hurt anyone else. That's it. May not sound like much, but in a civilized world, it's all we've got."
"Civilized world? Which always has parts that aren't civilized."
Decker shifted slightly in his seat, and more dramatically in his thoughts. "Who called it in? The incident at Lancaster's house?"
"Earl Lancaster did. He was out with Sandy at a school function. They didn't get home until nearly 11. That's when they found what they found and called 911.
"Anyone see or hear anything?"
"Still canvassing. Nothing yet. It was dark and messy. Easy enough to slip in. They could have brought the mannequins in deflated and then quickly inflated them."
He rubbed his forehead. "Thank God they didn't opt for the real thing. Which is puzzling, since they've had no problem killing anyone."
Miller nodded thoughtfully.
"You know, it's like these people can turn invisible."
"Not invisible. Innocuous."
"How do you mean?" asked Miller.
"Non-threatening, blend in. Someone so commonplace that no one notices them even though they're there. That makes them invisible because people don't remember them."
"Well, one of them dressed like a cop to snare Lafferty."
"Not a cop. A cop draws notice. They use that disguise specifically to get to Lafferty."
"No, I mean in a neighborhood, someone that just blends in."
"Well, we'll have the canvassing reports at both places ready in about an hour. Why don't you come down to the precinct and go over them?"
Decker eyed his former commander.
"Is this busy work?"
Miller rose. "Amos, you're a grown man. If you want to kill yourself, you will. Nothing I can do to stop that. But while I have you alive and kicking, I'd like to avail myself of your services.
So let's go down to the precinct and see what we can see."
He turned and walked out the door.
Decker sat there for a few seconds, then rose, grabbed his gun, slipped it into his coat pocket, and followed. Chapter 50 Four cups of coffee and a stale breakfast burrito later, Decker pushed back from the table where he had been going over all aspects of the case and hit the John. When he came out, Alex Jameson was leaning against the wall, apparently waiting for him. She looked up at him, her arms folded across her chest, her heel tapping against the dulled linoleum.
"I guess I missed my flight out of here,"
she said.
"There's always another one."
"Maybe. Maybe I'll go someplace warm when we're all done here."
"This is not your fight or your concern."
"Don't even go there, Decker."
"What are you doing here?"
"I wanted to see you, let you know that I was still working the case. Ann Miller called me. He knew I went with you to the Institute and that I was with you when you found Sizemore."
"So?"
Miller appeared from around the corner.
"So I thought another pair of fresh eyes on this sucker can't hurt. I'm not too proud to ask for help."
He pointed at the two of them.
"So why don't you get to it?"
"She's not on the force."
"Neither are you,"
shot back Jameson.
"Where's Lancaster?" asked Decker.
"Where she should be, with her family. Now go."
Decker reluctantly led Jameson back to the room, and they started going back over the statements given to the police. Both were from neighbors of the Lancasters. An old woman and a dog. And a dog. Non-threatening. Something folks would just gloss over, not remember unless specifically asked. He dialed up his DVR and went back over the canvassing reports from his neighborhood that the police had undertaken after the murders of his family. No old woman with a dog, but there had been an old man seen out for a stroll. He had been described as slightly bent, feeble, supported by a cane, and totally at odds with the violent slaughter that had occurred that night, no doubt perpetuated by a strong homicidal man in his prime. Totally innocuous. Nobody gave him a second thought. Nobody wondered who he was. Or why he was there that night. Including me. There had been no forced entry at the Lancasters. They'd apparently walked right in. An old woman in disguise. An old man in disguise. His killer seemed to be a true chameleon. Decker glanced back at the file on the Lancasters. Walked right in. He thought back to last night. The house had been neat and tidy. Mary had been working impossible hours. Earl, he knew, while a competent contractor, had his hands full with their daughter Sandy. He didn't see the guy vacuuming, dusting, and doing the dishes every 5 minutes. He rose from the table and headed out. He had questions that needed answers. He had apparently forgotten that Jameson was even there until she said,
"Where are we going?"
"I'm going somewhere. I don't know where you're going."
"But I'm safer with you, right?"
Decker struggled to find a reply to this, but then just gave up. Jameson held up her keys.
"And unlike you, I have a car."
"No, you have half a car." Decker stalked out, with Jameson scurrying after him. Against her wishes, Lancaster also had been placed in protective custody and was staying in a house rented by the FBI and guarded both by local Burlington cops and bureau agents. Decker cleared the security and entered the house with Jameson. Little Sandy had run forward and thrown her arms around Decker's legs. Not knowing what else to do, he had patted her on the head until she let go, stared straight up at him, and said,
"You're Amos Decker."
"I know I am. And you're Sandra Elizabeth Lancaster."
She had wagged a finger at him.
"I know I am."
Then she ran off, with her bedraggled father trying to keep up behind her. Decker and Jameson had sat down opposite Lancaster, who eyed her suspiciously.
"Why are you here? Like Decker here, I'm a consultant on the case. I never knew a case to have so many consultants,"
said Lancaster. Then she settled her gaze on Decker.
"How are you doing?"
"I'm doing," said Decker.
"Those heartless pricks. What they did at my house. Recreate your crime scene."
Jameson shot Decker a startled look.
"You didn't know?"
asked Lancaster.
"No,"
said Jameson quietly.
"Fortunately for us, they used mannequins instead of real people,"
said Lancaster. She shivered, took out a pack of smokes, and then put them away again. Decker eyed her. She said,
"I'm trying to quit, for Sandy's sake." "Secondhand smoke?"
said Jameson.
"No, I never smoke in the house or car. I meant I wanted to be alive to see her grow up, especially after..."
She reached into her pocket, pulled out a tissue, and dabbed at her eyes as she looked away, embarrassed. She stuffed the tissue back into her pocket and said,
"I don't want to be here. I want to be working the case. Those bastards came into my house and did that. I want them more than I've wanted anyone in my whole career."
"Did you or Earl hire a cleaning service for your house?" Decker asked. She looked puzzled.
"A cleaning service?
I know how security conscious you are, especially with Sandy. How she got out of the house that one time and you didn't find her for hours."
"What is your point, Decker?"
she snapped. "No forced entry at your house. They just walked in, Mary. I wonder how that could be, Unless someone had a key. Earl and Sandy had gone out. He locked up, right?
Yes, he always does. And you're right, Earl did hire a maid service, but they don't have a key to our house. We'd never have allowed that. Earl knew when they were coming, and he let them in.
But once in the house, could someone posing as a maid have gotten access to a key, made a copy of it, and used it to enter the house later?
But how would they know he'd even hired a maid?
If they were watching the house, they could see the car or van pull up. They usually have signs on them.
But how could they impersonate a maid?
Call the service and ask them if someone posing as you or Earl called and cancel them coming on one of their work days.
Decker, do you really...
It's just a phone call, Mary. And it might be a break for us. You said you wanted to be working the case. So work. She slipped out her phone and called the maid service. From the word she spoke, Decker knew the answer before she hung up.
You were right, Amos. They got a call saying not to come.
So that's when the fake maid came and made an impression of the key. You keep your keys where?
On hooks by the side door.
I saw a calendar on your fridge. It has everybody's schedule?
Yes.
So that's how they knew Earl and Sandy would be out that night.
I can't believe the person who did all this was in my house,
said Lancaster, staring at her hands.
I just can't believe it.
She glanced up.
That means Earl has seen the killer. Maybe...
Decker shook his head. The person won't look anything like Earl's description now. They're too smart for that, Mary. Decker rose and looked down at her. Jameson followed suit. Will you be okay here? He asked.
We'll be safe, if that's what you mean.
Right now, that's what I mean.
I'm lucky, Amos. My family is alive.
This was a warning, Mary. A warning to me. I didn't do what they wanted me to do. There will be no more warnings. Which means I have to get to them before they get to anyone else. He turned to leave with Jameson.
Where are you going now?
Lancaster stared at him like he was the last person left on Earth except for her. If Decker could have felt sympathy, he would have been deeply moved. To look at a video one more time.
What video?
Of someone getting out of a car. Chapter 51. Decker had watched the video on the laptop a dozen times, both at regular speed and in slow motion. Then he had sat back in his chair, closed his eyes. She had come over, the order given, the beer delivered. She had walked away. He had seen her once more sauntering along the bar, slender hips twitching enticingly before disappearing into the rear of the place. Then he had seen her once more, here, on the screen, getting out of the car, over and over and over. Everything he had seen replayed in his head. He went up and down her body over and over again, his mind focused on the little part of the face that he had seen. And then it clicked. His DVR had finally come through for him. He opened his eyes to see Agent Bogart standing there. He and Jameson were in the library at Mansfield. "You went to see Lancaster?" asked Bogart. Decker nodded, his thoughts still on the images in his head. "How's she doing? Do you still have your jet handy?" Bogart looked surprised by this. He perched on the edge of the table. "Yes, why? Can I get a ride on it?" "If I say you can. What's up?" Decker rose. "We need to get to Chicago." "You were just there. I need to go again." "You have a lead?" Bogart glanced at the laptop screen. His eagerness was palpable. "I have a lead."
"Can I come too?"
asked Jameson quickly. Bogart looked at her and then at Decker. The latter shrugged. Bogart said, "Okay, but keep in mind that the FBI is not running a freaking airline service, and not one word of anything gets printed."
"I quit my job at the paper."
"What?" said Decker. "Why?"
"I'm working this case full-time now, and I couldn't do my other reporting duties, and quite frankly, it was time to move on."
She got up and snagged her bag.
So let's go. Chop, chop.
She walked out of the room. Bogart looked at Decker.
A real piece of work. What'd you do to deserve her?
I can't process that right now, said Decker. The jet flew them to a private airstrip south of the Windy City, and they took an SUV to the new headquarters of the Cognitive Institute. It was in a three-story building in a campus-style office park about an hour outside of Chicago. Bogart flashed his FBI credentials at the receptionist, which started a chain reaction that ended with their being escorted to a conference room in the back of the building, outfitted in soothing earth colors. A man in a dark three-piece suit, with a pink shirt and yellow bow tie with green dots, came in. He looked at Bogart, who flashed his badge and introduced himself. Then Darren Marshall saw Decker. Amos Decker? Decker rose and shook his hand.
Dr. Marshall.
It's been what, 20 years?
Plus 2 months, 9 days, and 14 hours, said Decker automatically.
The calculation came out of his head so fast he didn't even realize he was doing it. It didn't seem weird to him anymore. It just was who he was now.
Of course, I will take your word for it, said Marshall.
He glanced at Bogart. Amos was quite an exceptional case.
I'm sure, but I know nothing about it.
Marshall next looked at Jameson.
And are you also with the FBI?
No, I'm just an interested citizen trying to help.
Marshall looked a bit startled by her comment.
Exceptional case? Prompted Bogart.
Decker said tersely, I suffered a head trauma. It changed how my mind worked. Made it more efficient in some ways. He paused. A manufactured savant, as it were. Unlike your brother. Bogart nodded, studying him closely.
Okay, right, I get that. Can you tell me what this is all about? Asked Marshall.
Decker explained the situation to Marshall, who slowly nodded before he was finished.
I had heard about poor Sizemore, of course, but I didn't know it as part of this awful event in Burlington.
We had mentioned it to Dr. Rabinowitz, said Decker.
So that's why he was calling, said Marshall. I've been so busy I haven't called Harold back yet.
It's connected to even more awful events, said Bogart, none of which we need to get into at present. He glanced expectantly at Decker.
Decker said, Our killer is almost certainly a male who has partnered with someone calling himself Sebastian Leopold.
Never heard of him. But you think it has a connection to the Institute?
Considering that it was their carefully placed clues that led me back here, yes.
And add the fact that Dr. Sizemore has been murdered. And you know they're connected for certain. I mean, Sizemore's death and the others.
Another message was left at his home, again, from me.
Marshall slumped back in his chair, looking highly unnerved.
My God, I can hardly believe it.
Decker said, There was a woman in my group at the Institute, Belinda Wyatt.
Yes, I remember her.
She was one of Dr. Sizemore's proteges.
Well, we don't encourage such attachments here.
But that doesn't mean they didn't happen.
In fact, is it correct to say that Dr. Sizemore was let go from here because he had formed an attachment with patients more recently? Perhaps female patients?
I really can't get into that.
Bogart leaned forward across the width of the table.
Dr. Marshall, we are hunting a killer who murdered more people than I care to mention, including a slew of high school students and one of my agents. This person has to be stopped before he kills again, so while I respect that you have confidences to maintain, any help you can give us will be much appreciated.
Marshall let out a long, uneven breath.
Well, I can tell you that Sizemore had crossed the professional line with a female at the Institute around the time that he was asked to leave. I really can't say more than that.
Don't worry. He's not going to sue you, said Bogart. He's lying in a morgue.
He glanced at Decker. Do you think Sizemore,
Might have done the same thing with this Wyatt person? Decker ignored this query and said to Marshall, "What happened to her?"
"I would have to check the records."
"Will you do that?"
"This is very treacherous territory, professionally speaking."
"Please, Dr. Marshall, just check the records." Marshall rose and picked up the phone on the credenza and spoke into it. 5 minutes later, a woman entered carrying a bulky expendable file folder. She handed it to Dr. Marshall, turned, and left. Marshall slipped on his glasses and said, "I'll need to look over the file." Bogart said,
"Go right ahead. Take your time."
20 minutes passed, and then Marshall looked up.
"Okay. What would you like to know?"
"What was her age then?" asked Decker.
16.
"She was a hyper?"
"Yes, of extraordinary ability. Close to yours, in fact. But unlike you, she exhibited no signs of synesthesia."
"Which made my case more interesting to some here," said Decker. "The duality of it.
And also how you came by it. Blunt force trauma on the gridiron. Never had one before you. I seriously doubt we'll ever see another."
Bogart looked at Decker.
"So that's how it happened?"
Jameson nodded at him.
"Yes."
"She knows this, but I don't?"
said Bogart irritably.
Jameson explained,
"We spent some long car rides together."
Decker said to Marshall, "How did Belinda come by hers? We had group sessions, but that fact was never revealed. Although some of the others here learned about my situation through the grapevine, I don't remember Belinda's ever being mentioned." "Well, your background should not have been disclosed, and Belinda's was even more complicated."
"How complicated?" asked Bogart.
When Marshall said nothing, Bogart said, "I don't want to play hardball, but I can have a subpoena here in an hour. But in that time, these people might kill again." Marshall looked over at Decker.
"Do you really think that this might be connected with all those deaths?"
"I know that it is." Marshall took off his glasses and slid the file away. Belinda Wyatt was a teenager living in rural Utah. When she was 16, she was, to put it bluntly, gang-raped, sodomized, brutally beaten, and left for dead. Bogart glanced sharply at Decker, but the latter kept his gaze on Marshall. "So she suffered a brain trauma from her injuries, and she came out of it with hyperthymesia," said Decker.
"Yes. And she also suffered a great deal of emotional trauma, as you can imagine," added Marshall.
"Enough that realistically, a full recovery was never going to happen. She was permanently damaged from it, emotionally and physically as well. With the physical damage done, she would never be able to conceive a child, for instance."
"My God,"
commented Jameson. Bogart said, "But Decker, I'm not following this. Why, it's a girl. She can't be our shooter. It's a guy."
"She can be our shooter. She is our shooter."
Bogart glanced at him sharply. "How do you figure that exactly?" Decker looked at Marshall. "Belinda had issues, didn't she? Other than her being beaten and raped, having to do with sexual orientation, perhaps?" Marshall said in amazement, "I really don't know how you possibly could have known that. To my knowledge, that was never mentioned in any session. I can't exactly explain it, other than in my head some things came together. The line of a jaw, the curve of a thigh, the hands, and mannerisms and movements, all jumbled together. Pieces of a puzzle. Your mind is truly extraordinary, Amos."
"So, was that why she was raped and brutalized?
I would guess 20 years ago in rural Utah, someone like that would not be very popular. I was not privy to the exact details of the crime, but that could have been the case, yes. I'm not sure how far we've come as a society, actually. I would imagine that sort of condition would still provoke severe, if totally misguided, reactions."
"What exactly were her medical conditions?" asked Decker.
Marshall seemed about to protest, but then resignation swept over his features. 20 years ago, Belinda Wyatt would have been classified as suffering from true hermaphroditism. Jameson said.
You mean like a hermaphrodite?
Yes, said Marshall. Now that's an arcane term, no longer in use because it's more than a bit insensitive. Today we call such conditions intersex, or DSD, which is an acronym for Disorders of Sexual Development. That's where there's a discrepancy between the external and internal genitalia, meaning testes and ovaries respectively, and also where you may have female chromosomes, but male genitalia, or vice versa. It has four known categories. Belinda technically belonged to a subset of the condition known as true gonadal intersex. Which means what, exactly? Asked Decker. That the person has both ovarian and testicular tissue. Belinda also had both XX and XY chromosomes. She also had one ovary and one testes. As you can imagine, it would be a difficult condition for anyone. The medical community has come a long way now in terms of helping the person to deal with the situation, to make choices, surgical and otherwise. 20 years ago, the decision was often made to have surgery immediately and to make the patient a woman in lieu of a man because the surgical procedures tended to be easier. Now we know there are many other factors involved. It's often better to wait and come to understand each person's unique situation and to allow the patient to have substantial input into the decision. I mean, it's their body and life after all. But 20 years ago, said Decker. It was very different, said Marshall. And people could be very ignorant and extremely cruel. Why, it was 16 and in high school. That time period is perilous enough for many young people who do not have to deal with, well, being different biologically from other people their age. Jameson said darkly,
so whoever gang-raped and beat her probably knew about her condition, and they were of the ignorant variety, and they decided to teach the girl a lesson?
Presumably, yes. And her parents? Asked Decker. Since she was not at the age of majority at the time, they had to give their authorization for her to come to the Institute. Did they have a visitor? No. Why not? To put it delicately, I would number them among the ignorant.
God. Talk about being totally abandoned by your parents when you need them most,
remarked Jameson. So they thought their daughter was what, a freak? Asked Decker. I spoke with them on the phone a few times. I don't think they cared what happened to her. Thoroughly unpleasant people. Bogart said, why were you privy to all of this medical information on patients at the Institute? I thought you just did research on cognitive issues. We approach things from a wider perspective. Yes, our primary focus is research into minds that are or have become extraordinary through various factors. But we also are medical doctors. The patients we saw, like Belinda and also Amos, had suffered serious trauma, which in turn caused enormous changes inside their minds. We needed to know their complete medical histories so that we could better understand what had caused the changes and also, we hoped, help them cope with what was essentially a new life. He looked at Decker. I know we never did any follow-up with you, Amos. That was a gap in our procedures that we have since rectified. Simply because you leave us physically does not mean we cannot continue to support you. Your help was much appreciated, said Decker. It enabled me to cope on my own. I'm so glad to hear you say that. Now, in Belinda's case, it was quite evident to us that she was a special case, even had she not suffered what she did. I had frank discussions with the doctor in Utah who had seen her and given the preliminary diagnosis of her condition. It's a total package, particularly when one is dealing with the mind, so we needed to understand everything. And her parents had no objection. I think they wanted to wash their hands of it. He added with a grimace. Did Belinda receive an operation that made her a man? Asked Decker. I don't know. She did not have such a procedure before or while she was here. That is for certain. Have you heard from her since she left here? Not a word. Do you have an address for Belinda? Asked Decker. No. Her parents?
In the file, yes, but it's 15 years old. Decker said, we'll take it.
Chapter 52. Decker sat at the table, looking out the window. Jameson sat across from him, watching him nervously. In an effort to lighten the mood, she said,
okay, I have to admit, this beats my Suzuki.
You mean your clown car, commented Decker, still peering out the window.
They were traveling at 41,000 feet and well over 500 miles an hour in the Bureau's sleek tri-engine Falcon.
He looked up when Bogart placed cups of coffee in front of him and Jameson, then sat down across from him. The FBI agent unbuttoned his jacket and took a sip from his own cup. Jameson looked around the plush interior.
Nice ride.
Bogart nodded. The FBI pulls out all the stops for cases like this.
He eyed Decker, who was still staring out the window.
So you took a hit on the football field and it changed your life forever.
It changed my brain, and with it my life.
And again, you don't want to talk about it?
Decker said nothing.
What do you think we'll find at the Wyatt's house in Colorado?
Asked Jameson, peering anxiously between the two men. Decker said,
whatever we find will tell us something we didn't know before, and it will get us one step closer to Belinda Wyatt.
Bogart took another sip of coffee.
What made you look in Wyatt's direction? We were searching for a man, and she's a woman. Or she was when you knew her.
In answer, Decker opened the laptop in front of him and spun it around so Bogart could see the screen. Then he ran the video. Bogart looked at the frames and then turned back to Decker.
Okay, it's a woman getting out of a car. The waitress from the bar. Leopold's accomplice. Maybe this Belinda Wyatt person. She certainly looks like a woman to me.
Did you notice how the person got out of the car?
Bogart glanced at the screen. You said it was a guy masquerading as a woman. But now that we know Wyatt has this intersex condition, we don't really know what she is, male or female. So it could just be her being a woman because she is a woman. Maybe she never had the operation.
That's right. She may be exactly what she was 20 years ago. We know Leopold couldn't have committed the murders. If Wyatt is involved with him, that leaves her. She's the shooter.
Okay, but I'm not getting what you mean about her climbing out of the car. She swung her legs out and stood up, like a girl or a guy would.
No, not like a guy would. Nothing like a guy would.
I'm not following.
Turn to the side and stand up, like you're getting out of a car.
What, now?
Yes, now.
Decker.
Just do it.
Bogart looked put out, but he turned to his side and put his legs out into the aisle. He was about to stand when Decker stopped him.
Look at your legs.
Bogart stared down at his splayed legs.
What about them?
I swung them out into the aisle, which I have to do in order to stand up. The person on the screen did the exact same thing.
Look at the distance between your thighs.
Bogart stared down at the large gap between his legs.
So what?
Look at the screen.
Bogart glanced at the screen.
There, the person's thighs were nearly touching.
Look at the hand, added Decker.
Bogart looked at the person's hand. It was knifed into the narrow crevice between the thighs, edging the skirt down.
Your legs were spread out and your hand was nowhere near your legs.
Well, she's wearing a dress, I'm not.
Doesn't matter. You're a guy, and wearing a dress or not, you wouldn't do it. You'd spread your legs and stand. And the person's in an alley. No one is there to catch a glimpse up the dress. So why keep the legs together? Why place your hand there for added security to prevent prying eyes?
I give up. Why?
Is the difference between being raised female and male. Women do that motion automatically. It's ingrained in them from an early age. As soon as they start wearing a jumper and tights and then a dress or skirt. My wife taught our daughter that motion when she was just a little girl.
Every mom does. But a guy would never think to do it. Never. Dress or no dress. Guys don't worry about people looking, because guys are always the ones who are looking. Bogart stared down at his legs, and then at his hand, and lastly, over at the screen where the frozen image showed explicitly everything that Decker had just explained. He looked at Jameson, who had been following this conversation closely. Before he could say anything, she swung her legs out into the aisle. She was wearing a skirt. Her knees were pressed together, and her hand was in the same position as the person on the video.
"It is hammered into us, Agent Bogart,"
she noted.
"Just like Decker said, it's just automatic, especially when one is wearing a skirt."
Bogart exclaimed, "So, let me get this straight. Are you saying that our shooter is a woman, Decker?" "I'm saying that if our shooter is Belinda Wyatt, and I believe she is, then she has retained the muscle memory from when she was raised as a girl. Whether she's now a man after having surgery, I don't know. Ironically enough, she may like that, after having been considered a freak for straddling genders, because she's now able to use it to her full advantage. She's a chameleon gender-wise. She can play both roles. It makes for a very effective cover." Bogart swung his legs back in and rested his elbows on the table. Jameson did the same.
"Why do you think she kills Sizemore?" asked Bogart.
"That's the other reason I started to focus on Wyatt. She has her favorite. He made that clear to me. He never told me about her background, but he spent a great deal of time with her."
"Okay. But why would she kill him, then?"
Decker gazed at Bogart with a look of disappointment. "It's pretty obvious, isn't it? He seduced her and had sex with her while she was at the Institute." Jameson and Bogart stared at him goggle-eyed.
"Damn,"
said Jameson.
"That does make sense. Sizemore was a slime ball. He got kicked out of the Institute for doing that very same thing with another female patient."
Bogart said, "So he seduced this physically and emotionally battered teenager when she was at her most vulnerable, just so he could get laid? Some favorite." Decker said nothing to this. He had returned to gazing out the window.
"You don't miss much, do you?" noted Bogart.
"So as long as I see it or hear it, then it's always with me."
Jameson said,
"But what if someone tells you a lie? You remember it, but not necessarily as a lie, right?"
"Unless I'm told something else that doesn't align with the earlier statement. Then I can start to figure out what's true and what's not. Small things tend to lead to big results. People don't mess up on the big details. They fall down on the small ones."
"What about Leopold? How did those two hook up?"
Decker looked back out the window and watched the clouds pass by. He had no answer to that question. He might never have an answer to that question.
Belinda Wyatt and Sebastian Leopold, two of the most unlikely partners ever. But like the two killers in Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, people paired together could do things unimaginable to each of them acting alone. And he wondered what they were plotting right now.
Chapter 53. The address in Colorado was at the foot of the Rocky Mountains, up a long paved road that had only a single house at the end that one reached through a motorized gate. But it was a substantial home, an estate, really. The SUVs slowly made their way up. An FBI team from Denver had met them at the private airport where the jet had landed. There were eight agents plus Bogart, Jameson, and Decker. Local law enforcement was down below keeping guard over the road.
"It's out of the way," said Bogart, as the large two-story home came into view.
"Did you expect it not to be?" said Decker. When they pulled to a stop, Bogart looked at Jameson.
"You stay put."
"Come on. Decker wouldn't let me go in Sizemore's place either."
"Well, I'm pleased to be considered in the same league with Mr. Decker," retorted Bogart. "Until we get the all clear, you stay right here."
They climbed out of the SUVs, and the team quickly surrounded the house. A large separate building
that looked to be a four-car garage was set off to one side. There was a pool in the rear grounds, covered now for winter. There were no other buildings, and there were no cars visible either.
"Place looks abandoned," said Bogart. "With such a nice residence, the grounds are pretty let go."
"We'll see," replied Decker. The air was cold, and everyone's breath was visible. Two agents went toward the garage while the others headed for the house. Three went to the rear, and the other half covered the front. With Decker next to him, Bogart knocked on the front door, identified himself, said that he had a search warrant, and asked to be let in. All he got in answer was silence. He gave the countdown over his phone to the team in the rear. Both doors were blown in by hydraulic battering rams. The agents swarmed inside, clearing the rooms one by one until they came up the stairs. They headed up, cleared six bedrooms, and then stopped at the last one. "Holy shit," said one of the agents, lowering his weapon. Bogart and Decker entered the room and stared down at the two chairs situated in the sitting room off the main bedroom area. There was a body in each chair, entirely wrapped in plastic that was compressed tightly around their figures. The faces visible through the plastic were of a man and a woman.
"Mr. and Mrs. Wyatt, do you think?" asked Bogart. "Anything is possible," replied Decker.
8 hours later, the forensic team and ME had finished their work. The bodies had been identified as Lane Wyatt and his wife, Ashby. Their time of death was hard to pin down because they had been embalmed.
"Damnest thing," said the ME.
"But it's well done. Whoever did it had some experience doing it."
"So all the blood removed and the fluid pumped into them?" said Bogart.
The man nodded. "And then they were wrapped in the plastic, and it looks like someone used a heat source to compress and then seal the plastic. Probably used a hairdryer. That and the embalming really preserved the body. No air could get in. The bodies are in remarkable shape. And they could have been here a long time or a short time? I'll try to work up a TOD window for you, but it won't be easy." Bogart said, "The cars in the garage are between 2 and 4 years old, and the registrations are still current. And the food in the fridge, while expired, is not that old. And the house is in reasonably good shape. I don't think they've been dead for years, unless someone has been living here while they've been in their packages." He looked at the ME.
"Cause of death?"
"Not particularly evident. No visible wounds on the bodies. Could have been poison, but obvious signs would be long gone. There might be some trace of it in their tissue, and I might be able to get some blood out of them. There's usually some left, even with embalming."
"Find what you can," urged Bogart.
The ME nodded and left. Bogart turned his attention to Decker and Jameson, who were sitting at the kitchen table going over some papers they'd taken out of a shoebox. Bogart sat across from Decker.
"Well, at least there were no cryptic messages to you painted on the walls."
Decker nodded absently and said, "I doubt they expected us to get to here, which is actually a good thing."
"Why?"
"It means they're fallible, and it means we're closing the gap. The tortoise and the hare, remember?"
"But why leave the bodies like that? They must have assumed someone would find them."
Decker looked at him. "According to what your people found out, the Wyatts were retired. They had no family other than their daughter and no friends. They kept to themselves."
"So folks might not have missed them," said Bogart, "at least for a while."
"We should check to see if they used a pool service company. The pool was probably only winterized a couple months ago. If they came up to do it, they might have seen the Wyatts."
"Good idea."
Decker said, "The Wyatts had money. This place is over 10,000 square feet, and there's a Range Rover, Audi A8, and Mercedes S500 in the garage."
"Money can't buy you happiness, I guess,"
remarked Jameson.
Bogart looked back down at the papers.
"What do you have there?"
Jameson said,
Letters from Belinda to her parents when she was at the Institute. Your team found them in that shoebox stuffed under some junk in a closet upstairs.
What do they say? Decker said, to sum it up, they're letters from a frightened young woman imploring her parents to come see her, to come take her home. Marshall said they never visited her, so her letters went unanswered. Marshall said they were part of the ignorant folks and really didn't care about her. I wonder why they kept the letters. Because of this, said Decker. He and Jameson laid the reverse side of all the letters out on the table side by side. Each page had a single capital letter written on the back. When read together and combined into words, they spelled out something.
I will kill them all, read Bogart.
So she will kill them all? Meaning her attackers? Or people who dissed her, said Decker, glancing up at Jameson. Or people associated with the one who dissed her. And you still don't know why Wyatt would think you did that to her? No, but my wife and Special Agent Lafferty were both violated. Not raped, but sexually mutilated. But Belinda was raped, and Mrs. Wyatt wasn't mutilated. She wouldn't be. This didn't start with her, and she's not connected to me. Comes back to you again. Always you. Jameson looked at Bogart.
Decker said you used to be an analyst at Quantico?
That's right.
I have a friend at VICAP.
She has lots of friends, commented Decker dryly. Bogart said, violent criminal apprehension program. I was assigned there for 2 years. Jameson said,
then you must have seen things like this before.
Bogart nodded. I've pretty much seen it all.
Okay, so walk us through it. What would the mutilation symbolize?
Bogart clasped his hands in front of him. Actually, mutilation of the female genitalia can have a lot of reasons behind it. It's like a cornucopia of psychoses. Freud would have had a field day with it. I've seen a number of cases, all serial killers, where it was employed. Then give us some examples of reasons, said Decker. Bogart leaned in, and while his voice grew softer, it also grew firmer. It can be symbolic of a hatred of women and what they represent, being mothers, giving birth. The female genitalia are the gates to the birth canal, to be a little crude about it. I've seen killers do that to women because their mothers abandoned them, or let them be abused by others. Mothers are supposed to protect their children, always be there for them. When a mother doesn't do that, it can lead to some really messed up minds. The mutilation is a way of closing those gates, shutting off the birth canal permanently. Not that murder didn't already do that, but in their minds, they're actually doing something positive. Decker said, meaning another child can't be born to that woman and won't be abandoned or abused? Exactly. Jameson interjected.
Well, Belinda's parents abandoned her to her fate at the Institute. They never visited her there. They ignored her pleas to come and get her. And could she have seen the rape and beating she endured as her mother's not protecting her?
Possibly, replied Bogart. In fact, probably. Particularly if she wasn't supportive afterwards. Decker said, but then why was the message directed at me? Why target my family, people I know? Where do I fit in all this? I don't remember even speaking to her. We're talking about a sick mind, Decker. There's no way we can understand or make sense out of what went on in her head. This actually didn't start with you. This started with her being raped and nearly killed, and then her parents abandoning her afterwards. And it started even before that, with her condition and people's reaction to it. Her life was never going to be normal.
And then there's Leopold. Let's not forget about him.
And then there's Leopold, repeated Bogart. Decker, you're still convinced he's Belinda's partner in all this? I mean, you haven't seen him since he left that bar. I know you told me about the waitress, supposedly Belinda,
and her borrowing the barman's car, but you have no hard evidence that she actually picked up Leopold in it. She could have just used it to run an errand.
Decker shook his head. She left the bar for good after she brought the car back. And the temp agency hadn't sent her. She was there to ferret Leopold away. He was the one who picked the bar. So I have no doubt that he's involved. He confessed to a crime he couldn't have committed. And he knew that he couldn't have committed. He played the role of a mentally unbalanced person well. But sitting in the bar, he had moments of lucidity, not random, but intentional. He overplayed his hand. He knew exactly what he was doing.
But why confess in the first place?
It was their opening salvo. After murdering my family, the confession got my attention. They knew I'd find out about it, investigate it. They lured me in. They wanted me to participate in their game.
Some game, Bogart said disgustedly. But they waited a long time in between killing your family and attacking the school.
It all took time to plan out. They had to find the details of the passageway, among other things. Jameson said,
But who's the leader of the pack, Wyatt or Leopold? Plus, how did they meet? Where does he come from? How did they hatch this whole thing?
All good questions, noted Decker, for which we unfortunately have no answers. Bogart said,
We've had no hit on the criminal databases. The guy has no record that we can find.
Decker jerked his head.
Criminal databases? Yeah, that's where we typically look for criminals. We ran Leopold's prints through IAFIS. It's the largest criminal database in the world. I should know because the FBI runs it.
But Belinda Wyatt wasn't a criminal. She was a victim. Maybe Sebastian Leopold was too. Maybe that's how they hooked up. Jameson gazed at Bogart.
So maybe you've been looking in the wrong databases.
Chapter 54. They flew back to Burlington, and Decker was driven to the Residence Inn. Decker looked at Bogart and then flicked his gaze to Jameson.
The FBI agent understood. He said, Miss Jameson, we request the pleasure of your company at our safe house.
She snapped.
What? No, I'll be...
Perfectly happy to accept, or else I'll put you in a jail cell if I have to, interjected Bogart.
On what charge?
Publishing false information in a newspaper and inciting a riot against one Amos Decker.
Jameson started to say something, but then sank back in her seat and said with a scowl,
Fine. Have it your way.
As Decker was climbing out of the SUV, Bogart hooked his arm.
We pop anything on Leopold's prints and DNA in non-criminal databases. I'll call you right away.
I'd also like you to send me whatever you can find on Belinda Wyatt's past.
Bogart nodded, and then he drove off. Decker headed up to his room and sat on his bed. He eyed the gun in his waistband and thought back to when Captain Miller had come knocking on his door. If he hadn't, would he have shot himself? With the clarity that came after stepping back from a stressful situation, Decker knew that Miller was right. If he eliminated himself, this pair would go on killing. If Decker had somehow dissed Belinda Wyatt, others could have too. Or maybe they would start on Leopold's list of dissers next.
He closed his eyes and thought back to two periods of time. One recent, the other much further in the past.
He took the latter first, stopping at those frames in his mind. Belinda Wyatt, tall, blonde, thin, and androgynous-looking, scared all the time. Her personality had been so invisible as not to exist, although her mind could do extraordinary things after what had happened to her. Decker recalled her as lacking confidence and even a shred of self-esteem. She barely talked in the group sessions. Decker had felt for her, to the extent he could with the new way his mind worked. What had happened to him was brutal, but he had stepped out onto that field of his own free will
and with the knowledge that pro football was insanely violent, far more vicious than even the most diehard fan could imagine. Belinda Wyatt had been gang-raped, sodomized, beaten, and left for dead. She had been horribly violated. There was nothing voluntary about that. She had had no say in it. She had been dealing with a difficult enough life situation as it was. With the discovery of her parents' bodies, it was clear that she was involved in all the other killings. And nothing in her past, no matter how horrific, would justify her doing what she had. But she was not the only one to blame for all this. Next, Decker's mind moved forward to the recent past. He was sitting in the jail cell opposite Sebastian Leopold. He recalled, down to the last detail, the man's features and manner. The empty eyes, the utter calmness, the disregard for his personal safety since he had confessed to a triple murder. Of course, now Decker knew that Leopold was aware he would never be convicted of those crimes because he had a rock-hard alibi, supplied by the police, of all people. That had to mean that Belinda Wyatt had murdered his family. And she had to be the shooter at Mansfield, too. Once again, Leopold had an alibi, provided once more by the police. Decker's mind ground to a halt at that point. By the police? Was that important? Significant? Imperative to understand? He didn't know, because he didn't have enough information. The frames whirred back and forth in his head, going over every word of the conversation between him and Leopold. Then the frames stopped whirring, and Decker's eyes opened. Is good. Even though he had perfect recall, sometimes his mind, just like anyone else's, turned words into what it thought they should be instead of what they actually had been. He had done that here, mentally correcting Leopold when no correction was necessary. Decker had just assumed it was a contraction. Is good to it's good. He had modified the words that way because he thought he had just misheard. But he hadn't. He couldn't have. He was sitting right next to the man. He picked up his phone and called Bogart. You need to expand your search to the international databases focusing on Europe. Interpol should be able to help. Germany should be at the top of the list to start with. Why? Asked Bogart. Why the international angle? Because I remembered something wrong, and now I just remembered it right. Decker put the phone away. I don't really drink, but it's good. An American would say that all the time, but no American would say, I don't really drink, but is good. In fact, Leopold might have actually said, ist good. And the slight guttural undertones of the speech, coupled with the sharp angular bone structure of Leopold's face, made Decker believe he was European, possibly German or Austrian. There was enough homogeneity in those populations that the facial features were far more uniform over the generations than in melting pots like the U.S. So it might be that Belinda Wyatt, undoubtedly a homegrown American girl, perhaps turned boy, joined forces with an older European male. How did two such very different people meet? How did they come together to plan something like this? Decker felt sure that if they could track down Leopold's true identity, a lot of questions would start being answered. As he thought about this, another possibility entered his mind. He said out loud, 7-Eleven. That had undoubtedly been a clue. In her interview notes, Lancaster had instinctively interpreted it as a reference to the ubiquitous convenience stores. But was there more to it than that? Leopold had not wanted to come right out and say he was actually referring to 7-Eleven Ducton Avenue, but he had to know that Lancaster had misinterpreted his statement. She had actually asked him which 7-Eleven, and when Leopold had been noncommittal, she had just assumed it was the one closest to Decker's home. But Leopold had let that go. He would know that the police, that Decker more importantly, would check that out.
that he would go to that store in DeSalle and see what he could see. And that meant...
He might be wrong, but he didn't think so. In fact, Decker thought he was absolutely right. He left his room and headed back out into the night. Chapter 55. He spent 10 minutes watching the store from across the street. He saw people go in and people go out. Cars came and went, and still he kept watching. He was watching to see if anyone was watching him. When Decker was satisfied that there was no one doing so, he hurried across the street and approached the door. He glanced through the glass and saw the same woman at the counter, once more counting packs of cigarettes and ticking them off on her sheets. He could see no other customers in the store. He opened the door and the bell tinkled. The woman looked up. It took her a moment, but she recognized Decker. Because of his size and appearance, he was hard to forget and harder to miss.
"You're back?"
she said.
"I'm back," said Decker, his gaze darting around the corners of the store.
His hand had slipped to his pocket, where his gun sat. She said,
"I owe you change from when you were here last. The coffee, pastry, and paper didn't add up to $5.
"Keep the change. You work long hours."